and welcome back to Sounding It Out, a podcast dedicated to audiology, brought to you by Signia UK and Ireland. I'm Julia Van Hastin, your host and head of audiology at Signia. This is the second episode of a mini-series about the wax management crisis we are facing here in the UK. As we discussed in the last episode, the situation started to deteriorate in 2019 when the British Medical Association decided it would no longer be considered part of the core services GPs were obliged to provide. It's created a postcode lottery for patients suffering from earwax. The RNAD, or Royal National Institute for Deaf People, are concerned that the situation is risking people's hearing health, with hearing loss, earache, tinnitus, and dizziness as some of the symptoms. In the last episode, I spoke to Frankie Oliver, audiology advisor at RNID, about their worries.
I don't think we can really overstate the risks that people can pose when they are forced to try and remove wax themselves. People are being forced to do this because private removal is either inaccessible or too expensive, or they're just not able to access any care on the NHS. So people are using dangerous methods to try and remove wax, and then this is posing a risk to the really kind of delicate anatomy of the middle ear, and therefore posing a risk to someone's hearing.
If you missed the conversation, you can go back and listen for free. In this mini-series, we're speaking to people in the profession who have come up with some innovative solutions. I'm going to be joined by people who have found new and inventive ways of tackling the problem in their trusts, and we will draw on that expertise. My first guest is Mark Newman, who is the head of audiology at the Barking, Havering and Redbridge University Trust. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Julia, and thank you for asking me along.
Mark, you've taken a really fresh approach to tackling earwax management in your trust. Can you explain what you've done and why it was needed, please?
As with a lot of audiology departments, we were very frustrated at seeing our patients come through the door for our GP direct access appointments, and also seeing our existing patients where they'd have problems with their hearing aids and we would find wax in the ears. And also a lot of our direct access patients are being triaged over the phone by the GPs, having a telephone appointment, then being sent through to us with not even looking in the ear. It's always been a frustrating thing for us as caring clinicians trying to provide good care for our patients, having to just stop the appointment and send them back to the GP, knowing full well that the services weren't really there to help them. We found that between about 12 and 14% of our patients, although this could vary, were coming in with wax at one point or other. The problem is, as you know, change takes a long time within the NHS, but I was very, very determined to see this one through. Seeing these patients in my clinics, I could share with their frustration as to how long this whole process took, and it just wasn't very satisfactory for me as a clinician trying to provide care as well. So what I managed to do was actually negotiate a audiology-led wax removal clinic with the full blessing of the ICBs as they are now, or the CCGs as they were then, which meant we had a fully funded audiology-led wax removal clinic.
Wow. So my next question then is, of course, going to be how you managed to get this agreement with your CCG. How did you go about conversations, and what arguments did you use to justify the cost to them?
Well, I was quite lucky because I've only been in this department about 4 years, but we're doing an awful lot of change and we're trying to make and just trying to shuffle things around really and make things a bit better for the patient. So during that time, I've already managed to get a good line of communication with the CCGs or ICBs as they are now, of course. And I was already attending a couple of the meetings, which is quite important to get a foot in the door. It's actually very difficult as this line of management to actually kind of get access to the people who can make the decisions. So sometimes you need to do a little bit of maneuvering and ensure you're in the right meetings with the right people in order to make effective change. During that, I was able to add the wax removal process to the agenda. I'd already done my research. I had all my stats. I had all the kind of quality data to show the need. And of course, on these meetings were representatives from the GPs. So I was able to draw on the GPs' frustrations with the management of wax. And they were a very good voice in terms of supporting my cause. And also, I asked a few patients just to put a few notes to me so I could quote them as saying, look, these are from real-life patients. These are their frustrations and their issues. it would alleviate an awful lot of pressure on the primary care. So just through basically through these meetings, I was able to demonstrate there is a dire need for the wax removal. I was able to demonstrate that we had capacity, and I was able to demonstrate that we would be able to do a good and professional job by taking the wax out. It also helps to clean up the process as well. So instead of all this boomeranging about referred to earlier, it would be like a bit of a one-stop shop. Sometimes we were able to take the wax out on the day, but obviously we're all running very busy clinics. So what we'd normally do is ask them to use drops for between a week and a half, and then book them into the following week. What we were able to do with that time, keeping things very flexible, the timetable helps, was able to do a hearing test and a DR continuation appointment immediately after taking the wax out. There was a consideration about temporary threshold shifts, but on the flip side, it was like in terms of patient access and in terms of like trying to provide that one-stop shop model, it was deemed more appropriate, both clinically and for patient convenience, to actually do the wax removal and then do the appointment soon or soon after. We'd normally have about half an hour gap to allow the patient to go and get a cup of tea and just kind of reboot for the next part of the appointment.
So what I'm hearing there is that you were able to, through these conversations and being involved in the meetings that mattered, to have a voice, you were able to talk about the benefits for the GPs, the benefits for the patients, the benefits for ENT, for your department. So really having a multi-angle approach to demonstrate the benefit of this wax setup that you have.
That was very important, Julia. So essentially you're trying to demonstrate how, I mean, obviously the CCGs and the ICPs, they're mostly concerned with money. So when you think about how much money it would cost for the GP to see this patient for the second time, for them to send them on to, say, an ENT consultant, we don't need ENT consultants taking wax out of people's ears. It's quite ridiculous to be charging that as a consultant outpatient appointment, and the cost and time to the patient as well, and the inconvenience of attending multiple clinics multiple times. Because we feel like, you know, there's an assumption that a lot of our patients are retired with nothing to do on their hands. But of course, we see patients from all walks of life and people are very busy nowadays. So it was about actually making clear the savings that people could find. And that's in the cost of saving in time for the GPs in primary care, in the ENT consultations, and of course, with us. At least if they're referred to our service, then at least we can actually take care of them. The other thing is the feedback I was getting from the GPs is that they just want to say, this patient has an ear problem. Can you please deal with it? We don't really want them coming back and forth. You don't really need to ask for our permission to do this or that or the other. This is a patient with an ear problem. Regardless of the cause, it'd be really good if you could just sort it all out. And I think that was a very attractive proposition, which I managed to paint the picture to the ICBs, which allowed them to pass this through. And the savings in terms of the costings, I was putting it roughly against the cost of staff and administration and rooms and so on and so forth. But throughout the NHS, we use HRG codes, and I was able to adapt that as a template. And the CCGs were quite happy with the cost I came up to, which I couldn't actually reveal, obviously, because that'd be... but yes, it was quite amenable all round.
Thank you for that, Mark. And I'm sure that our listeners will take lots and lots of really good information and advice away from that, because there's many steps to the answer that you've just talked me through. I'm interested, though, how long has the service been going, the audiology-led wax service? And you talk about all the steps that you had to go through. When did you start the process with your CCGs? How long did the whole thing take?
So the whole thing probably took about a year and a half, maybe a little bit longer. It wasn't easy. It was just a huge amount of persistence. There were several points where you felt you were just banging your head against the wall. There were several times where me and my deputy thought, we're really, really trying this and not getting anywhere. We could just open up a private wax removal business ourselves and then retire in our 50s, I think, given the amount of people coming through our doors with wax. However, it did take about a year and a half, really. It has to be signed off by contracts. It has to be signed off by finance, by the senior management here, the senior management over in the CCGs and ICBs, and there was a few other bits and pieces. So our actual wax removal service has been going on for nearly 2 years now. I think we kicked it off in January of 2020. We had a few kind of mock test clinics going back to, say, October the year before. We were also quite keen to make sure we gave a quality service and to give assurance to other audiologists in the department, but also the ENT and our senior management. So as such, we did a few test ears under the care of the ENT. A lot of audiologists had already, incidentally, been taking wax out for 9 or 10 years or longer. But we thought just to go through a kind of a reassurance and kind of like a clinical assurance program with ENT, we demonstrated our before and after pictures, talked through any complications and how we'd manage them, and they were quite happy to sign off on that.
Great success so far with your audiology-led wax clinic. You mentioned earlier that there were times where you were banging your head against the wall. Can you share some additional examples with our listeners of the main barriers that you faced during this lengthy process? You mentioned a year and a half, and maybe give them some advice, some practical advice on how to overcome these, because no doubt if somebody's listening to this podcast episode and they are thinking about following in your footsteps or your example, so to speak, they would want to have some shortcuts because you've already been through the process.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to create any obvious shortcuts, but for certain, you need to kind of highlight and illustrate the problem, which is well known. But also, you've got to provide the right solution. So getting that strong voice, both from your patients, from yourselves, from the GPs, all helps. You really have to kind of demonstrate your vision, though. Sell that idea. You need to demonstrate to your management, but you've got the capacity. You need to demonstrate how money will be saved. Again, managers listen when you tell them that they're going to save money. If you say, look, okay, we do a quick audit of your ENT clinics. How many of these referrals have been just for wax removal? You know, your ENT consultants could be doing something much more worthwhile with their time. We can take on that work. With the caveat, of course, but we are doing the more straightforward work and leaving the more complex stuff to the ENT guys.
Just out of interest, was there any surprises along the way in terms of barriers? Any strange protocols or procedures or questions that you were not expecting? I'll give you an example of a particular trust that was interested in trialing the Earways Pro Tool, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And their health and safety picked up on the fact that within their booths, they had carpet on the floor. And of course, we know that audiologically, when we perform a hearing test, you know, we don't want many reflective surfaces. So that was a little bit of a surprise to them. Have you had anything strange like that pop up in your experience?
As audiologists, I think we're used to all these like little random things, but do pop up from time to time. Certainly the carpeted rooms would be an issue. Thankfully, we've got a mixture of both carpeted rooms with the booths and more kind of straightforward clinic rooms with lino. We'd already got or procured a kind of a dentist chair type thing. I suppose really you just have to make sure that your communications are good. You would be surprised at the number of people who come out of the woodwork when these things go into production, as it were. One of the things we had to make sure, for example, that all the data was being collected efficiently from our clinics. That meant talking with the guys who pull the information off the back of audit base, for example, and ensuring that they match that against the HRG codes. So you're trying to get finance guys to talk to the data guys and come up with a solution that works for everyone. And then there's always little sort of bits and pieces. Make sure you've got your infection control guidelines done and dusted. Make sure you've got your SOPs in place. Make sure you communicate widely with ENT and the team to ensure that you're getting the right sort of patients. So we spent a lot of time just kind of refining our referral criteria.
So Mark, you mentioned earlier about the DMO1. In real life, how did you manage expectations in terms of delivering the hearing test within 6 weeks?
So this is actually quite a big thing. As we know, we're held to account on both our DMO1, which is our diagnostic pathway, which means we have to see patients within 6 weeks, and our RTT, referral to treat, which is the 18-week pathway. One problem we had with trying to obviously deliver the service within 6 weeks to include the wax removal, was that we might see them at week three, which is not too shabby. But by the time we actually got them in and spent a week and a half actually doing the oil and the drops or whatever we'd recommend, we were really pushing the 6 week margin. As such, I was able to negotiate an exemption from the DM01 for these patients, which meant that in a similar manner to a surgeon having to see a patient and saying, well, look, yes, you are very much suitable for, say, knee surgery, for example, but, you know, I want to get your heart rate sorted out first, or would like you to lose 2 or 3 stone to make it more beneficial to you in the long run and to save any kind of clinical complications when we're operating, I was able to use a similar mechanism to say, we can't pause the DM01, but they're actually exempt from the DM01 now because we have demonstrated that we're unable to complete the hearing test due to the wax being present. This, in fact, meant that we were able to see them at, say, week three, identify the wax, and were able then to take the wax out and then continue the testing and continue the direct referral appointment, but without having to worry about actually getting them in within the 6 weeks. We did try, for the most part, most of our patients get seen within that 6 weeks, but obviously with annual leave and sickness and so on and so forth, it was just nice to have that little bit of headroom so that if we did go over the 6 weeks, we wouldn't actually suffer any consequences for that. This meant that the actual service was actually viable, because obviously if we had to do everything within 6 weeks, that would make it very, very challenging to deliver that. So this was actually quite a critical point. Getting those patients exempt meant we was able to deliver the service without any dire consequences of running over the 6 weeks.
So kudos to you for making it all happen. And I am sure that there's many listeners that will take inspiration from your advice. Just out of interest, how big is your department and how many audiologists are delivering this audiology-led wax service? And did you have a certain selection criteria that you use to select these audiologists? Do they have to have a certain band or training?
So we are not the biggest department in the world, but we just have a high volume of patients through. We had about 3 or 4 audiologists delivering the service, and obviously people come and go. So we had the plan in place to do a continual training. A lot of audiologists had been taking wax out previously in different trusts. And coincidentally, I met my deputy Jonathan about a year and a half before I joined the department at a wax removal training session. So we made sure all of our audiologists had some relevant wax removal training, made sure that was all up to date, make sure they were confident, make sure we had ENT review our work, review our techniques, and are happy with that we could provide a safe service and we're confident in using the equipment. In terms of banding, we'd be band 6 or above, and it just makes sure they had some relevant training. We'd obviously have a little bit of a couple of sessions sitting in with them. We'd do a little portfolio, again, just to run past me and the deputy and also ENT, to ensure that everybody's happy and that the audiologists are comfortable and they feel safe doing the clinics.
And whilst we're on the topic of audiologists, I wonder how they've responded to this audiology-led wax removal service. You know, was there any objections before? Was there anything in particular that they liked or disliked about this new service? Did you have to do lots of convincing for the audiologists within the department in terms of the value to the department at all?
So the audiologists found this an absolutely fantastic idea and they were so happy when it's actually implemented. We all had massive frustrations with trying to see these patients and we really want to help them. And sometimes we'd allowed extra time in our appointments because we found that a lot of patients had a lot to say. We forget that at the time this was being launched, it was all coming out of like post-COVID and all this sort of thing. And our patients have had a horrible time and then a massive wait to see the GP and then to actually look in their ears and see wax. It's so frustrating. So it was really, really nice to be able to provide this service for them. We sat down with the whole department. We went through all the criteria. We took on board any suggestions or ideas that they had as a group, which was fabulous because it just posed a few questions maybe we hadn't thought about, and that just goes to show the importance of kind of involving the team as a wider decision-making process.
So yeah, it's important to get the buy-in from the team too. And that we can see that because you've had that, they are happy with how the service runs at the moment. I'm just interested also to see or hear whether you've had to create any extra capacity for your wax removal clinic. So I'm thinking, did you have to recruit any extra staff? Did you have to think about, you mentioned earlier that you had some rooms that was already suitable for it, but did you have to find some additional clinics in the diary? So how did that all work in terms of capacity?
Well, capacity is often an issue across the audiology world, as we're often forgotten about until too late, and then we're shoved in some basement or random part of the hospital, which is certainly the same for us. However, we were quite lucky in as much as a lot of the audiologists we had working, myself included, were very keen to do the wax removal clinics. We managed to find a bit of space in a suitable room. Capacity is an issue. We ultimately want to get to a direct access wax removal clinic, so the GPs can refer directly, electronically, from seeing the patient in front of them straight into our wax removal clinic against a certain criteria. But that is pending a little bit more of an expansion and capacity review within the department.
Yes, it's interesting that direct referral approach too. I know that one of our guests on the series, Nicola, who we'll be talking to in a different episode, has managed to set a similar service up where GPs are able to directly book into the primary care service for wax removal. So maybe have a chat with her and see what her tips are for getting that set up.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure if you have a huge amount of information to divulge, that'd be very interesting. Thank you.
On that note then, who is this wax removal service that you can run in its current format open to? How are patients able to access the service? Is it only through, you know, through referral from GP into a direct referral assessment, and then you place them on a different clinic? And also, alongside, whilst we are talking about patients, what is the feedback from the patients on this service?
So the service is available to all of our patients, primarily coming through the GP direct access route, because obviously they're the guys who really need the help most urgently. It might be worth picking up on the whole DMO1 thing in a minute, but certainly we try and see as many of the patients as we can, and also our existing patients who might come in for a retube or say that actually my hearing aid's not working. Check the hearing aid, everything's working, the hearing aid, we look in their ears and obviously it's block full of wax. We get those guys in as well. The criteria is probably quite universal, but we're only going to do the bread and butter things. So any patients with any complex issues would still go and see ENT. We've got to keep everything safe for the patient and ourselves as audiologists. So we go for a brief history, make sure there's no ear pain, discharge, perforations, any operations, any kind of unilateral losses, you know, history of epilepsy, just straightforward stuff like making sure they can keep their head still and if they're able to get in and out of a chair okay, because we might need to make the dentist chair we have just kind of rise up and down to ensure we can get a good view of the ears. In terms of the patient feedback, patients have been genuinely really grateful but we're able to do it. Unfortunately, we hear too often, but we have some quite bad experiences our patients have had from either the nurses or GPs try and take the wax out, or unfortunately, third-party providers as well. They haven't always had the best experience. And they just seem quite comfortable coming back to see us. Obviously, we spent that time with them doing all the history in the DR, and it's nice to have that sense of continuation. And we might not see them for the DR, but we do the DWAX, but we try and book them back with the same person they initially saw, if at all possible, just for that continuity. So they're finding it really useful, and not only the patients, but also the relatives of the patients, the husbands and wives and the sons and daughters who are finding it very, very useful. As we can start the audiological process of helping them with their hearing problems.
So all in all, really positive. I think you've got some stats for us about the number of patients that you were able to prevent being discharged back to their GPs because of your audiology-led wax clinic. Can you share some of those with our audience, please?
Certainly. So we do run this about every 2 months or so. I haven't quite had the time recently to do the October and November ones, and I didn't want to just make it up. But we did actually see 98 patients between August and September of this year in 2022, which was brilliant because it stopped nearly 100 patients from having to go back to the GP. And just all that extra time, if you think 100 appointments in primary care, or say half of them going to ENT and all the wait time, and you start, you know, doing the maths and you see it's actually been a really, really valuable service, which I'm very, very happy and proud to provide.
That's staggering numbers, really, if you think about it. Just as a out of interest, which wax removal tools do you and your department have in the toolbox, and when would you select a certain tool over another?
So we use a range of different tools within our arsenal for wax removal. Most of our audiologists, myself included, kind of grew up, I suppose, with microsuction, which is our first port of call. We also have various pulsing machines. I'm not too sure we can mention brands on here, but several are available and some a little bit better than others, which are handy for certain types of wax. We do obviously say to our patients, do use oil, but sometimes they're either they either forget, or occasionally they go, oh yeah, put it in this morning for you, and didn't quite get the assignment on doing it for the week or so. So it rather depends on the situation that presents in clinic. Microsuction is our first port of call. We also use the kind of micro pulsing water irrigation if that's indicated. But we've also started using the Earway Pro, which is a kind of a helical wax removal tool, which we've used with varying degrees of success. It does lend itself to getting us out of a little bit of trouble. I've used it a few times myself for certain patients, and had some good results with it. Last time I used it, I think I managed to get a partial removal, which was going to be very, very difficult with microsuction, but that revealed a little bit of softer wax behind it, which I was then able to take out much, much easier. So yeah, certainly a very good tool in our wax removal arsenal, and we're certainly looking at expanding the use of this to our home visit service, as it shows potential there. This is kind of pending a little bit of a clinical review, because obviously the patients we see in their own homes tend to be those with slightly more difficulties or additional clinical issues, which may prevent them from having their wax taken out in the first place, but certainly something we're looking to explore.
Thank you very much. And just for our listeners' sake, in our last episode in this series, we will have a little bit more from a guest that has been using the Earways Pro tool for quite some time. So we'll have some more information on that for you too. Mark, and this is my final question for you. You mentioned earlier that when you want to make a big change like this, you need to show that there will be some money savings and that there will also be some capacity improvements. Are you able to share with our listeners some of the cost and time savings that you've had before you've changed over and compare it to how the current service works?
It's a little bit of a tricky one. So obviously all this went into my kind of initial presentations to the CCG as it was then. I obviously didn't have the figures for how much does an appointment cost in a GP surgery, because that can vary, although I did give it a bit of a Google, of course. And of course we know, but the outpatient appointment for ENT is between about 120 to 180 pounds or something thereabouts, depending on the situation and the scenario. And just it was the cost of time, really, to the primary care and to ENT. And I think it was just a commonly held frustration, but we wasn't doing the right thing for the patient. I think the CCG understood, but since they made those changes, it put massive pressure on primary care, and of course massive frustration for the patients. They just want their wax out. They'll go to their GP in good faith thinking they can take it out, and they get told no, and then they get referred to ENT, and ENT say no, and then they just kind of go round and round in circles. So I think presenting a good solid case, good solid idea, backed by actual figures and facts that you can do this job and do it well, I think they weren't so worried about me demonstrating the actual costs to them within the primary care service. But certainly I could just say, look, we could do this for a modest fee. And they were more than happy to do that with all the other considerations taken on board.
Many thanks to you, Mark, for sharing your experiences and expertise. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation and I've learned a lot. I conclude that it takes fresh ideas, guts, determination, perseverance and resilience to get a CCG-funded audiology wax removal clinic. And clearly, you have all of those. Well done, and long may you, your department and your patients benefit.
No, thank you, Julia.
If you are interested in any further information from Mark, you can contact him on mark.newman7@nhs.net. In the next episode, I'll be speaking to Nicola Phillips, the Principal Clinical Scientist and Head of Primary Care Audiology at Swansea Bay University Health Board. She'll be talking about a trial that the Health Board have been doing since 2016.
All our patients access primary care audiology through their GP surgeries. In some practices, patients get triaged by the receptionist and booked directly into audiology slots, or the wax removal slots. In other practices, GPs will triage over the phone and then book them directly into clinics using a shared booking system.
I'll end by reminding our listeners of the RNID campaign's priorities, and that is firstly for earwax removal services to be brought back into primary care or community settings. Secondly, for the Department of Health and Social Care, NHS England and local health bodies to explore new models for delivering earwax removal services to make sure people can access timely and appropriate treatment. And thirdly, for the NHS to publish clear information on how people can manage earwax buildup themselves at home. If you found any of what you've heard in these episodes helpful, please tell your colleagues so as many people as possible can share the knowledge. And if there's a topic you think we should be covering, drop us an email to the address on the show page. And remember to follow wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. This is a Fresh Air production for Signia UK and Ireland. Until next time, goodbye.